his particular nightmares. "And yours?" he asked. She hesitated before answering. "The Jews," she said. "I dream about the Jews." He watched her. He saw her lower her eyes. "We murdered them," she said. "We took their houses, their businesses, everything. Then we sent them away to be killed." He did not say anything. People were only just beginning to talk about these things, and many simply refused to believe them. How could so many people be disposed of in that way? Surely it was impossible. But he knew it was true. "It happened," he said. She met his eyes. "It's our fault," she said. "We all became murderers. And it was not just the Jews. It was the gypsies and the insane and all sorts of people, all marched off to be killed." He wanted to do something for her evident pain. "You didn't do it personally," he said. "You're only accountable for things you do personally." She wanted to believe him, but it seemed to her that the crime was just too big. It required a whole nation to commit something on that scale. "There were some Jews here, you know," she said. "The party people painted signs on their doors. They broke their windows. I saw some of them doing it. I saw them from my kitchen window." "And what did I do?" "Nothing. I stood and watched." "You would have got into trouble if you tried to do anything," Ubi said. "People were sent to prison for less." "Oh, I know that," she said, suddenly sounding weary. "But the fact remains that I did nothing, and now we're paying for that. All this hardship is because of what we started." "We can begin again," said Ubi. "They might make us pay, but they can't make us all pay with our lives." She was staring at him. "You're ready to start again?" she asked. "Of course. And Germany will start up again. You watch." "I'm watching," she said wearily. There were 10 officers billeted at the inn. 5 of them spoke German, 2 of them with a facility approaching the fluency of a native speaker. 1 was an intelligence officer. The others were part of the military government for that part of the British sector. They were mostly concerned with mundane matters, transport and provisions, criminal justice. 2 had been lawyers in civilian life, and now found themselves dealing with the crimes of desperate people, and with the control of disease. Theft had become an almost natural response to shortage. If you were hungry, you stole. There was a simple, inarguable logic to that response. People who were not prepared to steal died, but they perished too of typhus and dysentery, and of sheer neglect. They died because nobody cared very much for them, not even their fellow citizens. One of the German-speaking officers asked Ubi whether he would like to learn English. "I could teach you," he said. "I'm sure you'll be a quick learner. And as payment, you can help me with my German. I'm still getting things wrong from time to time, and people are always using colloquial expressions that I've never come across before. It would be helpful to learn a few more of those." He readily agreed, and the lessons were conducted each day in the 20 minutes before dinner. Ilse liked to work in the kitchen by herself, and did not ask Ubi to help. "You'll have plenty to do once the plates are cleared," she said. He sat with the officer in the small parlour at the front of the inn. The officer had a book that he lent to Ubi. It had pictures of everyday things in it, with the English nouns printed below. "A hat," said Ubi, pointing to a picture of a man in a bowler hat, under which the word hat appeared. The man was looking towards the camera and smiling broadly. Ubi switched to German. "He doesn't look guilty, does he?" The officer looked surprised. "Why should he look guilty?" he asked. Ubi shrugged. "I suppose it's because so many people look guilty. I suppose I've come to expect it." He paused. "But then the man in this picture is English, isn't he?" "I think so," said the officer. "Look at the red buses in the background. That's always a giveaway, I find." "The English have nothing to feel guilty about," said Ubi. The officer smiled. "Nice of you to say that," he said. "But we also have a history, you know." Ubi stared at the officer. His face was unremarkable, although there was a certain pleasing regularity to it. His eyes were clear, and he looked straight at you when he spoke. That was an ability that came with never having done anything he was ashamed of, thought Ubi. There was a picture of a family drinking tea. Each person and each item was labelled with the appropriate English word. Father, mother, son, daughter, cup, saucer, teaspoon, and so on. Through the window could be seen a tree and a hill. It was a world that seemed to suit the softer nature of the words, even if Vater and Mutter clearly came from the same place as father and mother. This was not a language to shout in, thought Ubi. This was not a language with which to articulate threats, or invade, or terrify others. He was a quick learner, and he was soon able to read the cyclostyled newsletters that the British prepared for their own troops. The officer helped him with this, encouraging and complimenting as he stumbled through the easily smudged text. There was a piece about fraternization, a warning not to trust German civilians. "Do not talk to these people," read Ubi, enunciating each word carefully. "These people? Who were these people? Me?" The officer looked apologetic and switched to German to explain. "They don't really mean ordinary people, they mean people who might have been SS or something like that. People who haven't accepted the outcome. That's what this means." "But it says ordinary civilians," said Ubi. "We don't follow rules in quite the same way as you people do," said the officer. And then, as if to himself, "That's the trouble. I mean the trouble with you people, so to speak." And then, looking out of the window, and as if talking to himself rather than to Ubi, the officer continued, "I don't want to be here, you know. Like most people, I don't want to be here at all." "But if you weren't here," said Ubi, "wouldn't it be even more terrible?" The next 2 years passed quickly for Ubi. He was kept busy in the inn, and soon became indispensable, not only in the kitchen, but in the performance of a range of maintenance tasks. He became skilled in woodwork and in plumbing, and even managed to fathom and sort out the building's antiquated electrical wiring. He generally kept to himself. The war had been a waking nightmare, and now he wanted nothing so much as the peace and quiet of a modest, uncomplicated life. In April 1948, he had news of his family, thanks to the help of the officer who had been teaching him English. He used contacts in the British sector in Berlin to make inquiries on Ubi's behalf, and came up with the address of the landlord who had owned the building in which they had lived. This man responded, and told him that, unfortunately, his mother had been killed when a mortar shell came through the window in May 1945. His sister had gone to live with one of the other residents, a widow, and had stayed there until quite recently. He was sorry to report that she had become ill. It was typhus, he believed, and she too had died. She had a young child, he said, and the widow had looked after the little boy. The widow had moved, but he had her address as she had done some work for him, and he was still in touch with her. She had a small job and was hard up, but the boy was still with her, he thought. Ilse found him in the kitchen with the letter on the table in front of him. There was a pile of onion skins beside it, and when she saw his tears, she smiled. "Don't you know what to do?" she chided. "When you're peeling onions, you should have a tap running nearby. It stops you crying." She laughed and scooped the onion skins away to put in the compost, and then she realized her mistake. He gestured to the letter, inviting her to pick it up. She read the first few sentences, and then dropped it back on the table. She put her arms around him. "Ubi, Ubi." Somehow, in that moment, she felt that the sorrows of Germany had crystallized, and she wept too, not just for this woman and her daughter, who were just two amongst millions, but for everything, for all the hatred and injustice and revenge, for all the immeasurable pain. He told her that he should get back to Berlin, even if only to see what remained of their home, which might be nothing but an empty space, In pictures, Berlin looked a wasteland, a place in which troglodytes eked out an existence in the basements of ruins. Ilse tried to dissuade him, but she knew that he had to go. She had heard that from so many others, who had said that they were drawn back to the place where it happened, to the site of their loss. "And there's a child," he added, "my sister's child. I must see him." He was virtually alone now. He had lost all his family, and this unknown child was all he had. "Of course you must. I feel responsible, you see." A few weeks earlier, he and Ilse had become lovers, shyly and with very little being said about it. He had worked for her for over 2 years, and had become indispensable about the inn. He had repaired the roof, a task that took over 8 months, and had replaced rotten timbers on the ground floor, scouring bomb sites for wood, shaping each by hand. It was comfort and tenderness that lay at the heart of their relationship, rather than passion. It was as if they were children lost in a wood, holding on to one another in the darkness. "If you go to Berlin," she said, "will you come back here?" She did not say, "come back to me," as she did not want him to feel trapped. He replied that he would. "Of course I shall." And then he said, "and I'll ask you to marry me then." She hardly dared speak, but she managed to say, "Can I?" Because of... She hardly ever mentioned her husband, but he knew that he was called Erik. "Because of Erik." She nodded. "I suppose he's dead, but I think he must be." It was as if his words were an official confirmation. "Then, in that case, I can," she said. They left the discussion at that. He told her that he would be no more than a few weeks in Berlin, and would be back before she knew it. She smiled, and kissed his forehead gently. She said a prayer silently, because she believed in God, and she thought that he did not. "You can bring the child back," she whispered. "There's room for a child here." He stared at her, moved by her generosity. That had been evident from the very first day, when she had accosted him at the station, and it had continued. The soups, the comfortable bed, the laundering of his shirts, the bottles of burgundy diverted from the supplies of the British officers. "Are you sure?" "Of course." "I don't know anything about him," said Ubi. "I don't even know who the father is." An unspoken word hung in the air between them. Russian. On the evening before he was due to leave, one of the British officers, a newly arrived one, they were always changing, removed the tarpaulin from the abandoned motodrome. Several of his fellow officers joined him, some still in uniform, having just come off duty. They shouted to one another, and their laughter drifted back to the inn, where Ubi and Ilse were watching from a window. Ubi turned to Ilse. "Did they ask you?" She shrugged. "One said something about taking a look at it. Not that young one, the one with the bad skin, he asked me." Ubi wondered what they intended to do, and was about to ask her when he heard the motorcycle. One of the younger officers appeared from round the side of the building, riding an army motorbike. He looked at Ilse. "Do you think?" "They'd be mad," she said. "But then the British are mad, everybody knows that." The officers had managed to open a door in the side of the motodrome. The motorbike was now driven up to this, and the rider dismounted and pushed it inside. Ilse opened the window at which she and Ubi were standing. She shouted out towards the officers, "Careful! That's very dangerous!" The officers waved back gaily, but paid no attention. They heard the sound of the motorbike engine reverberating inside the motodrome, and then a thud, followed by silence. Laughter broke the silence, followed by raucous shouting, and then more laughter. "Boys," said Ilse. And then she thought about the war, and she thought, "Boys," again. Chapter 20. He had been prepared for the destruction he found in Berlin, although people he met there kept telling him how bad it had been a few years back, in 1945. "You wouldn't believe it," said the only one of his friends from school he managed to locate. Stoffi suffered from asthma, and that had saved his life, as he had been given a wireless operator's job that kept him far from the front line, almost up to the end. "You wouldn't believe the stench, Ubi, everywhere. Weeks, months of stench, because many of the Russians, the real peasants, came from places where there was no proper sanitation and they didn't know. The other thing they didn't know about was watches. They'd never had watches, and so they stole every watch they could get their hands on. They wore them all the way up their arms, 5 or 6 under each sleeve. But you couldn't laugh at them when they rolled their sleeves up and the watches appeared, because they could fly into a rage without any warning. Anywhere, everywhere, you wouldn't believe it, Ubi, you wouldn't." At first, he listened without making any comment of his own. Invasion, defeat, was a brute fact about which one could say very little, even if one was the guiltless victim. But in our case, he thought, we are far from guiltless, and so can say even less. We did it to them, and now they're doing it to us. Who could blame the Russians? "They're surrounded," said Stoffi. "And they'll turn the screws, of course they will." "But what can they do? What about the others, the Americans, the British, the French?" Stoffi shrugged. "They're surrounded too, at least in Berlin. They say the Russians are already making it more difficult for them to reach us here. They say that bridges are being repaired, or railway lines need work, that sort of thing." He paused to make a strangling motion with his hands. "They could squeeze us just like that, you know?" At least the streets were now clear of rubble. The burnt cars had been removed, and rebuilding had long since started. There were people on the streets, and they seemed to have proper shoes, or many of them did, and the trams and trains were running. The furtiveness that he had noticed in the early days of defeat seemed less common here. People walked rather than scurried. They looked one another in the eye rather than shiftily, warily. There were political notices and newspapers. There were still echoes of hopelessness, that indefinable air with which he had become so familiar. But there was something else now, something quite different, a sense of a future. People were doing things purposively. They were doing things that seemed to matter to them. Germany was making things again, and these things were beginning to appear in shops. Stoffi allowed him to sleep on the floor of the basement room he occupied. He gave him food and accompanied him when he went to look for the widow whose address he had been given. "People move a lot these days," Stoffi warned Ubi. "Don't be too disappointed if you find this woman has gone." But she had not. She answered the door in a neat apron, her hands covered with flour. She had been kneading dough. He told her who he was, and for a few moments she stared at him in confusion. Then, as she made sense of what he had said, she raised her hands to her face. When she lowered them, there were traces of flour on her eyebrows and cheekbones. She sat down heavily on a chair in the entrance hall and shook her head. "I thought you were all gone," she said. "All of you." He told her that he had been taken prisoner and had been released early. He told her how he had obtained her address. "I thought I should see my nephew," he explained. "I think my sister would have wanted that." "Of course. Of course. Your nephew." He waited. Children had died, too, many of them from malnutrition. Was he too late? She stood up. "Your nephew will be coming back very soon. A friend of mine has taken him to the shops. He won't be long." She invited them in. The flat was neat, but Spartan in its furnishing and decoration. Poverty manifested itself in the absence of anything of any value. People had sold their possessions in difficult times. A family heirloom might have been exchanged for a few loaves of bread. An item of jewellery, a ring, a brooch, could have brought in a few kilos of donkey meat. As he waited, he tried to make conversation. He asked about what had happened to his mother and his sister, but she was able to tell him very little. She had been somewhere else when his mother's flat had been hit. And his sister, whom she did not know very well, had died rather quickly. She had taken the child in because there did not seem to be anybody else, and it was her duty, she said, as a Christian. She did not know where either of them was buried. So many people, she said, had shallow graves that were either unmarked or only temporarily recorded. He asked the widow about the days after the Russians had arrived, but she clearly did not want to talk about that. She shuddered, though, involuntarily, and then started to discuss a Russian film she had seen the previous day. It had been beautifully filmed, she said, and if it had been propaganda, then that side of it had been lost on her, as she had no Russian. The friend returned with the boy half an hour later. She was carrying a large paper bag into which groceries had been stuffed. At her feet, clinging onto her skirts, was a small boy of about 3. He was wearing a tight-fitting cap that failed to cover his ears and a shabby red coat, and he stared at Ubi and Shrofi with the unembarrassed curiosity of the very young. The child was dark-skinned, his black hair knotted with small curls. Ubi smiled at the boy and then looked at the widow. She held his gaze almost defiantly, as if she were daring him to say something. "What's his name?" he asked. "Klaus," she said. Ubi stepped forward and bent down to address the child at his level. He reached out for the boy's right hand and held it briefly in his own. "So, you're Klaus," he said, "and I'm your uncle." The boy looked at the widow, as if to ask permission to respond. She smiled encouragingly, but he was too timid to say anything. Ubi stood up again. The widow stepped back. She had been about to whisper something into his ear. "An American father," she said. He looked at the child again. "I see," she nodded. "It was not easy for your sister," she said. "People abused her because of the child's being mixed race. Some people actually spat at her." His chest felt tight. "This man, the father, was she..." The widow knew what he was trying to ask. "No, don't think that. She said he was kind to her, and people had to make whatever arrangements they could in those times, you know?" He let out his breath slowly. "Did he know about the child?" The widow shrugged. "He may have. I don't know. Your sister told me that he had been sent somewhere else. He was a sergeant. She showed me a photograph." The child was watching him with widened eyes. He reached into his pocket and took out a small bar of chocolate, which he unwrapped. He offered it to the small boy, who hesitated, and then took it from him. "We need to talk," said Ubi. The widow nodded. "I would appreciate it if you were able to help in some way." "I'll take him," said Ubi. "If you don't mind letting him go, I'll take him back with me. I have a place to live, and I'm going to be getting married. We shall look after him well." The widow hesitated, but not for long. "I would have been happy to continue," she said. "I would never have turned him out, but it's such a struggle to get by." She looked at him hopelessly. It was a miracle, it seemed to him, that people managed to continue. From somewhere within themselves they found the will to persist, to scrape a living, to patch and mend, to find small ways of expressing their sense of beauty. A few flowers plucked and put in a cracked egg cup, serving as a vase, a printed picture cut from a magazine and pasted on cardboard, a splash of colour in a threadbare dress. He reached out and touched her arm. "I understand," he said, "and I'm very grateful to you. I really am." "You have work back there?" she asked. "Real work?" The labour draft had sucked up able-bodied men for construction, but the pay was minimal. He told her about the inn. "My fiancé," it was the first time he had used the word of Ilse, "my fiancé owns it." "Ah." He noticed a change in her expression. Was it envy? When most had nothing, the possession of something had to be concealed. So he said, "It's not a big place. It's a very modest concern. Just a few rooms." He was right. It had been envy, because the look disappeared. "Klaus will be well fed," he said. She prickled with resentment. "I've done my best on what I get." He was quick to reassure her. "I'm sure you have. And he looks very healthy, doesn't he?" He did not, and they both knew it. But she accepted the compliment, and then turned to Stoffi and asked him where he lived. Ubi bent down again to speak to the child, who continued to look at him with his wide, dark eyes, wondering whether to trust him. The chocolate had gone, leaving a smudge on the boy's upper lip. Ubi reached into his pocket and took out another bar, handing it over with a flourish. This brought a shy grin to the small face, as his nephew reached out to take possession of the treasure. They agreed that Ubi would leave the following week, once the child had had the chance to get used to his company. He would visit each day, and familiarity, and chocolate, would do its work. But as the day of departure approached, so its possibility receded. The boy had no papers, and the widow, at whose address he was registered for ration purposes, lived in the Soviet zone. Just as Stoffi had said, road and rail transport between Berlin and the outside world was now being deliberately cut by the Russians, as were transfers of food from the countryside to the non-Soviet zones of the city. "Stalin has two big weapons," said Stoffi. "Starvation and isolation. Watch him use them. Just watch him. There is nothing that man would not do." They attended a meeting, an impromptu gathering of neighbors addressed by a local liaison official. Somebody, a thin man wearing horn-rimmed glasses, brandished a French newspaper with its headline, "Berlin Crisis, a Challenge for the West." "They say here that America's going to give up," he said. "That's what the French think. Listen." He read out a few sentences, which he translated into German. "The French," called a woman from the back of the crowd. "What do they know? They're defeated just like us." "Not quite," said the liaison man. "But the Americans are not going to abandon us. There's an agreement." This brought laughter. "No," shouted the official. "No, you're wrong. General Clay isn't going to let it happen."
"What can he do?"
someone shouted. "They can force their way in."
"With tanks?
That'll be a war between America and Russia, and we'll be in the middle." A voice at the front said, "The way we were not all that long ago." Other views were expressed.
"General Clay won't risk that. He knows what the Russians are like."
And, "There's not much he can do. Look at the number of Russian tanks. They say they're bringing more in every day, piling them up. America's a long way away. How can they compete?" The official was becoming irritated.
"We shouldn't talk about things that haven't happened yet," he said. "We need to keep calm. The whole situation will probably be sorted out soon enough. The roads will reopen."
"Says who?" a man called out.
"We're finished," said the man with horn-rimmed glasses. "The Russians have got us. We're finished." The following day, when Stoffi came back to the flat, he had managed to buy half a large cured sausage and a loaf of crusty bread. They shared this, adding to the feast a piece of cheese that Ubi had bought from a woman on a tram, a mobile black marketeer selling her goods between stops. Stoffi had news. He was an electrician and his job was at Tempelhof Airport, which meant that his finger was on the pulse.
"They're going to do it," he said.
"They've already started."
"There are so many rumours," Ubi sighed. "How can one tell?"
Stoffi shook his head.
"No, this is true. This is happening. They're going to airlift everything in. The Russians can't close the air corridors."
Ubi looked doubtful.
"Everything?" "Yes," said Stoffi. "Everything the city needs."
He told Ubi that his boss at the airport had been briefed. They would be busy, he said, because the planes would be coming in non-stop.
Ubi said that he thought it would be impossible. "There are too many people," he said. "Think of the amount of food you'd have to bring in. Think of it."
"A lot," agreed Stoffi. "But then the Americans have lots of planes, and the British too."
"And coal," said Ubi. "You can't fly electricity in."
"Coal too," said Stoffi. "My boss said it would be everything, including fuel."
It seemed impossible.
But Stoffi assured Ubi that the planes were already coming in.
Tomorrow, he said. Come to Tempelhof tomorrow. Come and see for yourself.
I need to think about getting back, said Ubi. I need to go home.
Stoffi laughed. Too late, Ubi, he said. The roads, the railway, they're not going to open them. We're surrounded by Russia now. And that means you're in Berlin, I'm afraid, until all this ends.
Over the next few days, Ubi realized that Stoffi was right, and he was trapped. Travel would be impossible, particularly with an undocumented 3-year-old boy. He would wait it out. The blockade could not last forever, people said, and the Russians would soon realize how unpopular they were making themselves. Stoffi shook his head.
You don't know these people, he said. They don't think like us.
Ubi wrote to Ilse. Mail was still getting through by air, although it took some days to be dispatched and was sporadic. He told her that he would stay in Berlin for the time being, but would return when everything died down. Stoffi had said that he could get him a job at Tempelhof Airport, unloading planes. Flights were coming in now every few minutes, as the airlift began in earnest. People were needed to unload aircraft after they landed. The work was reasonably well paid, and food was provided at the end of each shift. There were worse ways, he said, of spending what would be, he felt, the short days of a crisis that would surely blow over soon enough.
I look forward so much to seeing you again, he wrote at the end of the letter. I miss you more than I can say, my dearest one. My love.
He looked at the sentence he had just written. He had not told her that before. He had not told her that he was in love with her, not in so many words. I am no Goethe, he thought, but now he said it, and something deep within him shifted, an emotional barrier that had been in place ever since the day he donned a uniform, a barrier that had stood between him and the outside world, a barrier designed to show others how strong and self-sufficient he was. It was the same, he thought, with so many men, with all the soldiers of the world, perhaps, who were made to seem what in reality they just were not. Part 3. In Friendship's Hands. Chapter 21. After their brief honeymoon, Mike returned to duty at the airfield, and Val went back to work on the farm. Archie had pretended not to notice her pregnancy, but now, with a certain embarrassment, he asked her about her plans.
Your baby, he said, looking anywhere but at the obvious bulge. He'll be an American, I suppose, now that you...
She smiled. His dad is, so I suppose he'll be too. I'm not sure how these things work. Archie nodded.
And you too, you'll be going over there?
Eventually.
With the baby?
Well, I'd hardly leave him here, would I? He smiled.
Of course. I wasn't thinking. He paused. Which means you won't be working here much longer.
She told him that she would work for a couple of months longer. She could do most things, but would probably avoid the heavier tasks if he did not mind.
Then I'll leave and wait for the baby. And what if they send your husband away? Asked Archie. They won't be here forever, what with the war ending and all that. You don't need all those planes now that them Germans have given up, do you?
We'll see, said Val. Mike thinks that they have to keep the planes somewhere, and he thinks they'll probably keep his people here for a while. He said they might have to go to Germany itself.
Archie shook his head. They don't want to go over there, he said. Bad place, that. And bombed to pieces, judging from the pictures in the paper.
Something was clearly bothering him, and he looked at her inquiringly.
He's still over at the base, he ventured, but you're at your aunt's place. Have they got housing for married couples?
She saw him blush.
No, she said, they haven't, not at the base, but we have a room at my aunt's, and he can spend weekends with me there. We get by.
He quickly changed the subject.
They would need to attend to the hens, he said. The fox had somehow found his way into the coop the previous night and taken the cockerel and two of his spouses. More than he could eat, Archie said, shaking his head. I'm going to get my hands on that fellow one of these days.
She settled back into her routine. Archie was careful about giving her only light work,
and he also insisted that she go home early each day. "You have to rest," he said, "in your condition." She had been concerned about Willie. She had been worried that he would be possessive, and that he would resent Mike's return, but her fears proved unfounded. On the first occasion that Mike stayed overnight, Willie was quiet over dinner, and she thought it was through resentment. But when Mike addressed a few remarks to him, asking him whether he had ever flown, this brought forth a torrent of questions. What happened if one of your engines stopped? Did the other keep the plane in the sky? What would happen if a wheel hit a rock on the runway? Could a plane fly upside down? Mike answered his questions patiently and with good humour. He had seen enough of Willie in the past to know that even if he found it difficult to deal with things that were a bit complicated, he was still kind and loyal, and could hold down a job, as long as it was not too demanding. He understood all that, he assured Val.
"We had a guy like that in the store," he told her. "He swept the floor and stacked the shelves, although he sometimes put things in the wrong place. His life's ambition was to be one of the sheriff's deputies. He used to wear a badge he'd picked up for a dime. But, of course, he could never be the real thing."
Val thought this was sad. "To want to be something that you can never be, that seems sad to me."
"And yet that's what life is like for a lot of folks," said Mike. "Not everybody has our luck."
She had not thought of it as luck. But now that he spoke of it in those terms, she could see that this was what it was. It had been luck that had brought them together when they'd been born into such different worlds. It was as a result of luck that his plane had come down on a field rather than a wood. It was luck that those Dutch people had hidden him. And it was luck that that German soldier had decided to do what he did. Everything was reducible to luck, right back to being born and the circumstances in which that took place. But could you ever do anything about your luck? Or was it an immutable hand of cards, dealt out once and to be played throughout life with no possibility of change? She had sometimes thought about that. People said that you got the luck you deserved, that if you behaved selfishly or cruelly, you would get the luck that came with such behaviour, and that, of course, was bad luck. Mike's luck had held out, she thought. So many flyers had not come back. He had told her about the melancholy duty of clearing out a friend's locker, as they had done with his when they thought he had died in the crash. That duty was one that cropped up time and time again, but was every bit as hard the fourth or fifth time as the first. Although they were married, she felt that she had no more than a tenuous hold on him. He belonged to the Air Force, it seemed, rather more than he belonged to her. If it was the Air Force's will that he should be sent somewhere, then what she felt about that counted for nothing. And so when he came to Annie's house one evening and told her that there was something he wanted to discuss with her in the village pub, she knew that this would be the news she was dreading, that of his posting. Her hand shook as she took the small glass of cider he had bought her. He noticed. He was concerned that she was still working on Archie's farm and would have preferred her to rest. She had said that it was better to remain active, that a baby thrived if its mother still did the things she normally did. "Are you worried about something?" he asked. She took a sip of the cider, savouring its sweetness. "About you," she said. "I know what you're going to tell me." She could tell from his expression it was not going to be good news.
"I'm going to Germany," he said. "I'm going to be flying transport planes, C-47s. They're really just military versions of DC-3s.
She looked at him blankly. She knew nothing of planes, although she could recognize the sort he flew.
"There is a base at Wiesbaden," Mike went on. "We took it over from the Germans. I'm going to be there."
She stared into her cider. "I'm going to be there. I'm...
And us?" she asked.
He bit his lip.
"We'll be fine."
"But you'll..."
"I have to be over there, yes. And at the moment they won't let us take wives."
He paused and reached for her hand.
"In the future, maybe. In fact, definitely. The Air Force doesn't like to split families."
"Then why..." he cut her short.
"Some posts are unaccompanied. It's just the way they are. They aren't sending me to Hawaii. It's to a country we've just been at war with. It's different."
"Couldn't you ask to go to Hawaii?"
he laughed. "Everybody wants to go to Hawaii. That's what Hawaii is for. It's a reward."
"Or even California," What about California? He shook his head. I have to go where I'm sent. It won't be forever. Maybe you'll be able to come over next year. Who knows? There was something else he wanted to discuss with her. You could be sent to the States, you know. They can arrange that. You don't have to stay here. She had not expected this. Without you? Yes, you'd get housing on a base, maybe. He was trying to sound optimistic. Or you can go to my mom and dad. In fact, that would be much easier. In Muncie, Indiana? He smiled. Yes, in Muncie, Indiana. You've always wanted to go there. You said, but that was with you. I don't want to go there by myself. He had spilled some of his beer on the table, and now he traced a pattern in it with a finger. They'd look after you, he said, and the baby too. But I don't know them. I'd be a stranger. You wouldn't. You'd be my wife. That's not a stranger. She shook her head. And it'd be different, wouldn't it? With a baby and everything. Even some of the words. You call nappies diapers, don't you? That's not a problem, surely. She was struggling with tears. It could be for me. He took her hand again. All right. All right. He sounded defeated, and she felt a pang of guilt. After what he had gone through, she should not make it harder for him than it was. You stay here. Have the baby at your aunt's place. We'll be together later. But in the meantime, he tried again to appear positive, in the meantime, you'll be comfortable here with your aunt and with Willie. And there's Peter Woodhouse. He can stay with you, of course. She hesitated, but finally decided. He's your dog now. Take him to Germany with you. He's an American dog. He grinned. Do dogs think like that? Do they care about these things? British dogs, American dogs, it's all the same to them. She smiled for the first time that evening, and he pressed her hand in his, encouraging her. Probably is, she said. But still, he's used to you. You take him. He looked thoughtful, and almost agreed, but then he shook his head and explained that it would be better for him to stay. This base is all right, he said, but who knows what it'll be like over there. No, this is his place, this country. This place probably smells right to him. You know how dogs are with their smells. She did not argue. He could go back to the farm, to Archie. He'll look after him. The best thing for him, said Mike. She felt the baby kick, and she took his hand and placed it on her stomach. He thought about what she had said about Peter Woodhouse. American babies, British babies, even German babies, they were all the same. Things went wrong only after they were born. He wanted to say something, but no words came. Being close to death can make us look at the world with different eyes. It was what the chaplain at the base had said to him on his return. He was referring to the crash, of course, but it had occurred to Mike that the observation could be interpreted more widely. Given that the human lifespan was so short, it might apply throughout life. We were always close to death, young or old. We did not have all that long. He had been about to say something to that effect, but he stopped himself. He had heard that the chaplain liked nothing more than a theological discussion, and had been known to detain a busy man for over an hour in the exploration of some abstruse point. On one famous occasion, he had even held up a mission, delaying the departure of avenging angels by almost 10 minutes. Chapter 22. He was already in Wiesbaden when the baby arrived. Annie went to the base to hand over the letter that one of the Air Force clerks had promised to get delivered within 2 or 3 days, unlike the normal post, which could take weeks to reach an overseas address. She wrote, "Your baby son has arrived safely. I'm writing to tell you this because Val is still in the hospital, and they don't want her to do anything very much just yet. We'll send a photograph as soon as we can arrange one, but Val said, tell Mike that he looks just like him. He took a long time to arrive. It wasn't easy for her, labor being that long and all, but he's here now, safe and sound, and as strong and as hungry as can be. One of the nurses says that American babies are all like that, all very strong, and maybe she's right. Val sends you her dearest love. She says to tell you that she thinks of you all the time, and that she knows you will love your new little Thomas Barnes Rogers, the moment you see him, which she hopes will be very soon. She sends you all her love and asks you not to worry about anything. She has everything she needs and is very happy. It was 5 days before she was allowed home, and then only on the strength of a promise from Annie that she would enforce bed rest for a further week. She had lost more blood than they would have liked, but gradually her strength returned. Thomas Barnes Rogers, such an impressive name for a baby, said Annie, or Tommy, as he had already become, was bundled up in ancient lace baby clothes from Annie's attic and wheeled about in a carriage pram that the midwife had summoned up from somewhere. Willie doted on the new arrival and would talk of nothing else over meals. Was Tommy sleeping enough? Should the district nurse be asked to come to listen to his chest? Was the house warm enough for him? Small babies did not like draughts, and they could get croup from them, he'd been told. You could never be too careful when they were that small. Calm down, Willie, said Annie. Babies are tough little things, especially large babies like this one. If he gets his milk regularly and the air in his room is kept warm, he'll thrive all right. You mark my words. Auntie's right, said Val. You don't want to wrap babies up too much. Their skin needs air on it. Nurse said that herself. That's exactly what she said. I know a thing or two, said Willie resentfully. I've read them books too. Of course you have, Willie, said Annie. And Tommy will be fine with you and Val looking after him, and the whole village behind him egging him on. He's going to grow into a fine little boy before any of us knows it. There were extra rations for a nursing mother, and Archie made sure that there was no shortage of eggs, butter and cream. Cream is what you need, he said to Val, standing awkwardly at the door of her room when he came to visit, fingering the brim of his cap, embarrassed to enter this room of mother and baby equipment, of bottles and towels, and the soft, slightly sour milk smell of a tiny infant. I can get you plenty of cream now. She asked him what he thought of the baby. He edged into the room and peered into the cradle. He's a proper healthy nipper, he said. Got your eyes, I think. She laughed. That's what Willie thinks, too. And when will they let your fellow come back? She sighed. I don't know, Archie. I'll go over there, I think, once everything's sorted out. There's not much housing yet, even for officers. He raised an eyebrow. You told me that before. I thought they always looked after officers. There are always houses for officers. Not over there, there's not. Archie nodded. You'll see him soon enough, I expect. He moved away from the cradle. And young fellow lad over there will keep you busy meanwhile. She inquired about the farm. Was he coping now that she was no longer working? He replied that he was, but that there were things he was having to give up. There would be no turnips next year, he thought, but the fields he normally grew them in could do with a rest anyway. And Willie? He said, looking over his shoulder towards the kitchen, where Willie and Annie could be heard conversing. Do you think he might want to come and work at my place? You could ask him. I don't see why not. Archie looked thoughtful. He's a good boy, that. Val agreed, and she was not just saying that. Willie was a good boy, even if he was impetuous at times, and even if he did go on and on about some subjects. Babies, currently, but that would change as something else attracted his attention. Willie's enthusiasm for Tommy proved not to be a passing phase. Not only did he continue to talk incessantly about him, thoughts of the baby occupying his every waking moment, but he proved to be a staunch ally in the watches of the night, when Tommy awoke to be fed, and he would make tea for Val, averting his eyes if he brought it to her as she was feeding the baby. Then he would wait outside the door until she called him back in, when he would take Tommy in his arms and rock him, murmuring in the low voice that the baby seemed to find calming. Val watched, and thought of how nobody would ever have dreamed that Willie would show qualities like this, would behave like the most devoted of fathers. She had spoken to him about Archie, and had been surprised by Willie's easy acceptance of the suggestion that he should leave the farm he was on. That would be all right with me, he said. I like Archie. He's a nice man to work for, said Val. He never asks you to do too much. He's kind. Willie nodded. And it'll be easier for me to look after Tommy if I work there, he said. Closer, you see. I can get back here quicker. She was silent. The attachment was deeper than she had imagined. She tried to be gentle. Of course, Tommy and I are going to have to go one of these days, Willie. Not now, mind, but maybe Well, maybe in a few months' time. She paused. Mike will be counting the days until he sees his boy for the first time. Willie looked away. I know that, he said. The next day, an idea occurred to her. The vicar visited and spoke to her about the christening. Have you discussed baptism with the father? He asked, searching his memory for the name. He had married them, after all, and he did try to remember all the names, but it was difficult. Mike, she said. No, I haven't spoken to him, but he'll not mind. I can write to him. The vicar said he thought this was the thing to do. I'm a great believer in early baptism, he said. As early as possible, I always say. She smiled. The vicar always said, I always say, round and round in a circle. I always say, I always say. And godparents? He asked. She had given the matter no thought, but that did not stop her replying. Willie, I think. The vicar inclined his head. He'll be very proud of that, I suspect. He will be. And the others? It's normal for a boy to have two godfathers and one godmother, and the other way round, mutatis mutandis. He smiled apologetically. Is that Latin? He laughed. Yes, it is. I know I shouldn't quote Latin. People don't always like it, but somehow, she said, smiling, we all do things we shouldn't do. Quoting Latin is not the worst thing you could do. The other godparents? The answer came just as easily as it had with Willie. There's Archie Wilkinson up at the farm. You know him? A good man, said the vicar. She looked at the vicar's shoes. They had been good shoes once, she thought, well-made black shoes in a style she had seen described as Oxford's, but now there were cracks in the leather, like lines across a furrowed brow. Of course, shoes had needed coupons for a long time, and now they were reduced to only 3 a week to cover everything. It was worse than in wartime, because now they had to clothe all those people in Germany who had nothing but the rags they stood up in. They started it, and it was their fault, she thought, but there were still people, and a lot of them were women and children who presumably had not wanted war in the first place, not really, even if there were those photographs showing them waving flags and saluting Hitler, just like the men. And my aunt, she said, she'd love to be godmother. I'm sure she would, said the vicar, but will you be discussing it with Mike? Yes, Mike. Ask the father, I always say, even if he's not there. You should be asked. She said she would do that, and she wrote about it in her next letter. He wrote back, whatever you want, my darling. Everything for you. You're the one. Everything. Now she could ask Willie, and the others too, but speaking to Willie she felt was the most important. He listened attentively, nodding his head as she spoke. Then, when she had finished, he said, Godfather. Yes, the vicar holds a service. We all go, even Tommy, and the vicar splashes him with water. Well, not actually splashes, just pours a little over his head. She paused. Sometimes it was difficult to work out just what Willie knew. You must have seen it, Willie. Of course I've seen it, he said. Lots of times, down at the church. Well, there you are. You know all about it. He looked thoughtful. Godfather, that's like being a father, sort of, when the father isn't there. Like that? She hesitated. Well, it's not quite that. It's not quite like being the father. That's different, you see. A father's... He cut her short. I know that. He gave her a reproachful look. He was sensitive to being thought not to know things. If people thought that he knew nothing, they were wrong. Often they were the ones who failed to grasp something that he knew perfectly well. How animals felt, for instance, or what the clouds meant for the weather ahead, or the various types of bird nest, or what was wrong with the country. And here was Val implying that he did not know what godfathers were for. Of course I know that. But when the father's away somewhere, or dead or something, then you still have the godfather, don't you? You could put it like that. But the main thing is that the godfather's kind to the baby. He remembers birthdays, that sort of thing. Willie grinned. I can do that, he said. Of course you can, Willie. The vicar's cracked shoes projected from under his white cassock, the hem of which was frayed, as everything was after 5 years of war and the shortages that war brought. There was even a smell to parsimony, some said, a thin, musty smell of things used beyond their natural life, of materials patched up, cobbled together, persuaded to do whatever it was they did well after they should have been retired. And it was true of people, too, with both young men and young women in uniform. Those left behind to do the day-to-day job seemed tired, overworked, made to carry on with their duties well after they should have been pensioned off. And now the vicar looked up at his small congregation and took a deep breath, as if summoning up for the task ahead what little energy he had left. Val sat in the front pew, flanked by Annie and Willie, with Archie, stiff in his ancient suit, on the other side of Willie. The vicar closed his eyes as he spoke, only opening them occasionally to look out on the heads of those in the pews. The familiar words required no reading. He had uttered them countless times before. At first, Val only half listened, being preoccupied with Tommy, who was awake but silent in her arms, all but completely covered in the christening robe Annie had made for him from scraps of white cotton and lace. But then she found herself following the vicar's words, drawn in by the poetry of the liturgy. "Beloved," he said, and Val thought, "That's us." And he continued, "You hear in this gospel the words of our Saviour Christ, that he commanded his children to be brought unto him. You perceive how, by his outward gesture and deed, he declared his good will toward them, for he embraced them in his arms, he laid his hands upon them, and blessed them. Doubt not, therefore, but earnestly believe, that he will likewise favourably receive this present infant, that he will embrace him with the arms of his mercy." Val did not think that God existed, but she liked the idea that he was there, even if it was no more than a fond hope, that thing that people called faith. Even the vicar, she thought, must have his doubts, because if God did exist, then why had he let all those people die in the war, all those innocent people herded into those camps and murdered, all those besieged Russians starving to death, eating rats to keep alive, all those children who died under the rain of bombs? Why did he allow all that, when, by one movement of his finger, he could have obliterated the Nazis and their works, stopped the slaughter and the suffering? Now the vicar held the little bundle in his arms and reached for a tarnished silver spoon on the edge of the font. He had said that the water would be warm as the River Jordan, he smilingly assured her, and he sprinkled a few drops on Tommy's forehead. The child's eyes opened, surprised, unfocused, but he did not cry, and he was handed back to her as she struggled to keep from crying herself. She was thinking of Mike, who would have been so proud at this moment, and would have put his arm around her, she thought. She missed him so painfully. It was an insistent, raw ache of longing, assuaged from time to time by the joy of having Tommy. But as the weeks of separation drew into months, she found it increasingly hard to remember what the man she had married had been like. Even his face was becoming blurred in her memory now. Their times together remembered, but in such a way as to make her ask herself whether she was recalling them correctly. What did his voice sound like? What did he say to her when he spoke about Indiana and the life he had led there? What did he whisper to her in their moments of intimacy? Her dreams began to disturb her. He appeared in some of them, but it was only to tell her that he had found somebody else, or to reveal that he was actually dead, and they had not got round to telling her yet, and he was sorry that she was the last to hear. In her dreams, she always said that it did not matter, that she still loved him, but for some reason, when she tried to address him, he was not there, but was in an unfamiliar place somewhere else, a place that was something like the Air Force base, but with no planes, just tractors. As places do in dreams, it had a fluid identity. It was a farm, and then it was not a farm, but the village, and then part of a landscape that she did not recognize, but that must have been Muncie, Indiana. He came back on leave when Tommy was 4 months old, and again 5 months later. They went to Cornwall, where they had spent their honeymoon, and stayed for a week in a boarding house where the food was cold and generally unpalatable. The woman who ran it offered to babysit, and they went to the local cinema, the Electric Palace.
After the film, they called in at a pub where a pianist played the White Cliffs of Dover and everybody started to sing. Looks were exchanged, looks of relief, coupled with nostalgia. A man, a perfect stranger, bought Mike a drink, saying, "In case people haven't said thank you." Mike said, "We did it together." And the man nodded, but said nothing further. Eventually,